Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
You're listening to the Sherlock's Podcast, your guide to a more stylish life. Hello, it's Georgie Courage-Cole, Sherlock's founder and CEO, and welcome to today's In Conversation With Podcast. It is well known that here at Sherlock's, we are passionate about supporting women in business. And today, I feel very lucky to be joined by three female founders who are, it says, making waves here. I mean, absolutely killing it in their respective fields would be more appropriate. A huge welcome, Connie Nam, the founder of Astrid & Mew, Laura Mead, co-founder of the lifestyle brand Varley, and Natasha Thomas, who is the founder of Total Management, a B2B travel and hospitality business, and more well known as the co-founder of Lockdown Liquor. Lovely to have you all.
Thanks for having us.
I feel really lucky to have witnessed all of your journeys over the years. And as I said in the introduction, we really love to support women doing their own thing at whatever stage they are. I don't know about you, but I feel quite lucky to be at an age where my peers are now doing mega cool things. It's great to look around and think, God, we met Connie so many years ago.
Yeah, like 10 years ago, maybe.
Now, and here you are with
the kids as well, right?
Yeah, it was before the kids because we first advertised through Sherlock's when I first launched the brand.
Long time ago, which was in what year?
Which was like 2012?
2012.
Yeah.
Well, for everybody listening, they will know you, but just as a recap, can you all give me a little, Laura, let's start with you, a little sort of elevator pitch to Varley, what you do, when you founded it?
Gosh, okay. So I'm Laura and I'm the co-founder of Varley. I founded the business 10 years this September with my husband, Ben. And we started off very much as I'm not 100% sure we actually knew what we were starting off as when we started, but it started off as a very selfish endeavor. It was just, we had a desire to build a life together and create something together. My background was, I grew up in this incredibly sporty family. My mum was a PE teacher, my dad was a professional footballer.
That's why I asked if you were a dancer.
Yeah, no, not a dancer. He was a footballer. And then I got into athletics at a very young age. So I spent my whole childhood running on a track and travelling around the UK competing. And I didn't know what I wanted to do after school, but I kind of thought I wanted to work in sport because I loved it and it's kind of all I knew. So I went to Manchester University and I got a job at the Professional Footballers Association. And I was adamant that I was going to be a football agent. And at the same time, I was still competing on the track.
What was your track event?
400 metres. So I lived in sports clothes. And I was working out before it was even fashionable. Like, nobody went training when I was at university. And there was no real clothes for it either. It was very much like Nike and Adidas. Yeah. And it was all very black and very boring. Anyways, I tried to get a job at a football agency and the agency that employed me also had a media arm. So they sent me to London, kicking and screaming, to work in TV, which wasn't what I wanted to do. But I kind of thought I'd have the experience and worked there for like about a year. And I didn't have any friends in London. So I signed up to the London Marathon when training in Richmond Park. And that's where I met Ben.
Training for the marathon?
Yeah. And that was kind of the start of the journey.
What year was that?
God... We did the marathon together in 2009.
Did you run together? Did you fall in love and run the marathon together?
We kind of fell in love in the park, then fell out of love, did the marathon, I beat him. And then fell back in love again, and then the rest is history. But we decided we wanted to build a brand together, and obviously I was hugely passionate about sports clothing, activewear, leisure wear. It was just the way I lived and I dressed at the time. And... I'd like to say that we saw a big gap in the market, but it wasn't that clever. And he's an incredibly talented person. So
what was he doing before?
He was working in finance. So he was hugely like analytical and obviously very good with numbers. But he'd also come from a family of brand builders because his dad was in advertising. So he grew up around like advertising and building a brand.
Helpful. Yeah. Great.
And that
great
was his dad.
And we have actually interviewed you and your husband in our business, careers and finance edition about
working
running
together
a business with your other half, which you do too, yes. Tash. And I have to say, I've always really admired. I've met many entrepreneurs over the years who also work with their husbands, from Anya Highmarsh and Bridgewater to Maria Hatzis-Stefanis, the founder of Radial. I mean, there are so many interior design couples as well. There are many. It's a really interesting conversation, I think.
Yeah, we were just talking about that actually just before we started this, and we were saying, you know, how much we enjoy it, because I think not everyone does think, you know, that would be such a nice path to go down, to work with your husband day in, day out. But I think I just love it. I really enjoy working with him. And I think we are such different people and we bring different things to the table. Mm-hmm. And I think when you can compliment yourself and have that unconditional support, I think that's really what counts.
Yeah.
I think, you
two
know...
Two brand builders is not quite...
No, and I think I'm so finance-driven, he's so creative, that when you marry the two up, it works really, really well. And I think that's really important. Yeah. But, you know, it isn't for everyone. You know, people say, how can you separate your, you know, your personal family life and you work together, you're not coming home every evening talking about work. And, you know, I think, you know, of course, there is a bit of that. You know, we do, it's natural, you would talk about what's happened during the course of the day. But as a whole, you know, I couldn't think of a better partner to have. I love working with them.
I think as well, I think a lot of people say, how can you do that? I mean, Tash and I are good friends out of work, and we will sit and chat and chat and chat about work and other businesses. And that's sort of a great interest. And my husband and I are the same. We don't work together, although he's a huge support. And actually, I feel like we'll never run out of conversation, A, and B, it's like our hobby.
Yeah.
So I think it's, if you're not in a career that is sort of like a child, it's hard to understand.
I'm the same. Like, we're not in business together, but me and my husband, we talk about business all the time. But I'm not sure whether I can work with him. Would you work with your husband?
Well,
I do like the separation.
I sort of, it's a good conversation. I think it's about, and seeing this with other people, I think it's about having your lane and staying in your lane and bringing your own unique skills to the table. I think actually, I always say we actually get on better the more time we spend together. I don't know, we're very different characters, but regardless, it's great to share it with somebody to some extent.
Yeah, the highs and the lows.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
because it's
definitely
a long ride running your own business.
And very, I can imagine for a lot of people who aren't in it with their partners or don't have a business partner, it's incredibly lonely.
Very lonely. And I'm very grateful to have someone who's been there from the beginning and really understands the highs and the lows, and there are plenty of lows. Tash, can you give us a bit of background? I mean, Total, as we've said, more B2B. Anyway, go and check it out, Total Management, if you're interested. They work with brands like Facebook, Spotify, providing all their corporate events.
Exactly, event and travel agency. But ultimately, that was a lot. I set that up in 2006. And then during the course of lockdown, as you can imagine, not many people doing events nor travel. So we had a little bit of time in our hands while that was just going through more of a, I guess, you know, online platform usage for that business. So myself and my husband, my co-founder, set up Lockdown Liquor, which is a RTD, ready-to-drink drinks business, specializing in cocktails. And, you know, we were, people often say, like, why did you think of setting up a drinks business? You know, you don't come from that business background. We had no, I guess, experience across that. We've always liked food and drink, especially tequila, you know, good food, testing different restaurants, etc. So when we were at home, I think you can all agree, everyone was experimenting with different foods, cocktails, etc. And we did say, wouldn't it be great to be able to just shake and pour rather than having to squeeze a million limes and lemons and make this concoction to serve out one drink. It was great to have a ready-to-drink solution. And Lockdown Liquor was born. We decided that that was something that we saw business niche in, and off we went.
You just sort of touched on something that I think is really interesting, which is doing something that you're passionate about. And I always remember somebody who worked, I won't go into details, but it was in the sort of fashion and accessories space, and she was very business minded, mm-hmm. and she said, I want to start a business, I'm going to develop a gap in the market, and da da da. And she created a business that was very successful for a while. And ultimately, she sort of lost interest a little bit. Mm. It wasn't for her. It wasn't her passion. Business was her passion. I suppose finding something that you're passionate about, and anyone who knows you knows that starting a drinks business and you really appreciate ingredients and how things are made and quality, and your world travels and knows that lockdown therefore makes real sense. You obviously, Lara said you were an athlete. Mm-hmm. You've developed Varley. You know, I always love shopping. Here I am.
Yeah.
You know, I do think finding your passion as well as being business-minded and combining the two. Yeah.
And I think also having a co-founder who, like myself and Jack, are so different. We bring, as I said earlier, two very different skill sets to the table. I don't think I could have done it on my own. Often people say, you know, without a co-founder, could you have got there? And I think absolutely not. You know, a lot of people presume because I've had a business before and, you know, I bring a lot of business knowledge, but without his design, passion, and level of detail, I don't think the brand would be where it is today.
And actually, my husband is a chartered accountant, and I always say, I remember writing, he wrote most of the first business plan, and the VC that backed us said, that's one of the best business plans we've read. I mean, let's be clear, I didn't write it.
Yeah.
I love that honesty, yeah.
So, you know, it's you and Jack, it's you and your husband. You say he had that analytical background.
I second that. I think because obviously Varley's at the moment a woman's brand, I think a lot of people maybe attribute a lot of the success to me. And actually, we wouldn't be where we were today if it wasn't for Ben.
I'd say the same. You launched lockdown in the pandemic.
Yes.
Can you sort of update us on the size and where the business is now? You've had phenomenal growth in terms of stockist distribution, etc. Just to give people listening, because you know, you're D2C, but you're also, you know, the entree is huge to the brand.
So when we started lockdown, it was obviously in lockdown, so predominantly a D2C brand. We were, 100% direct to consumer. As we shimmied out of lockdown, we transitioned that to be more on the entree, business led.
And so on-trade
is restaurants, hospitality, hotel rooms, airlines, theatres, anywhere where you can publicly get a drink. That's kind of known as the on-trade. And then obviously grocers, the likes of, you know, WH Smith, Tesco's, Waitrose, etc. We made a decision quite early that we wanted to go into more the hospitality. So that was the restaurant groups, the hotel, pub group, airlines, hotel rooms, bars, etc. So now we have got nearly 2,000 listings across the UK nationally. I think we still do a lot of direct consumer still, but I think the business line has taken over.
And I think that is the difference between you and other brands in the category.
Yeah.
Is that this on-trade is, as you said, 90% of your business, the 2,000 listings. I mean, that is huge.
And it's more solution-driven. We wanted to bring something that was providing a solution within the hospitality industry rather than just a nice drink to have at home anymore. When we came back out of lockdown, and then obviously with Brexit, a lot of the supply chain was damaged. So people weren't able to get goods into the UK, and people couldn't get good bartenders, etc. So what we wanted to do was come to the table with a solution rather than just a good tasting drink. Mm-hmm. And luckily we offer both solution plus the drinks taste great.
Before I come to you, Connie, and ask you for a sort of update on where you are, Lara, in terms of Varley, you opened the King's Road.
We did.
Which looks like it's been a massive success.
It's been amazing. It's an amazing
Can
site.
You sort of update us on sort of where you are in terms of bricks and mortar? And
so we, wholesale-wise, we started off as a wholesale business, so we had about 1,000 points of sale globally now in terms of wholesale partners. And in the US, you know, we've got everyone from Neiman, Saks, Nordstrom, they're some of our biggest partners. 80% of our revenue comes out of America, so it's very much our domestic market.
Is it really?
Yeah. Gosh, wow. We're very much known as being an American brand. We've got offices in LA, New York. And then retail-wise, we've got the King's Road, which we opened August this year. We've just opened Marylebone. August, Soho, New York, followed by San Francisco and then LA next year. So, yeah, mm-hmm. busy.
Big plans.
Yeah, big plans.
Connie, update us on the, triumph that is Astrid and Miu. When I met you, really early on, I remember you talking about wanting to create this sort of community and movement. And we see Monica Vinader and Miss Amira. You've really created something different. Tell us, you know, what is it, the essence of Astrid and Mew?
Yeah, so my mission is always to revolutionize the jewelry industry. It seems really grand, but I always want to do something very different. And we're thinking like 5 to 10 years ahead. So like, you know, you see a lot of brands popping up that are quite similar, but they don't know what we're thinking 5 years ahead. So we're always there to revolutionize and really lead what's in the market. And the inspiration was very simple, right? Like, I love jewelry. Jewelry was always like...
So again, you had that passion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it, like, jewelry was such an exciting category of fashion. I used to travel. I grew up between Korea and the US, as you can tell from my accent. And we used to travel a lot as a family. And wherever we went, my favorite pastime was to go to markets or and boutiques and pick out jewelry. So every single piece in my mom's jewelry box, they all had a meaning. So jewelry was always so exciting. Mm. But on the high street, it just wasn't exciting. Jewelry was a very flat and traditional category. So when I started Astrid & Mew, I knew there was something to make it accessible and exciting. There was no such thing as demi-fine category, which exists now. Like, there are so many cool brands now aside from Astrid & Mew, but it didn't exist. And I can proudly say that we kind of pioneered that category. And I guess like 12 years, like fast forward 12 years, we have 24 stores. We have one store in New York and West Village, and we have one in
Dublin.
When did
you open that one?
We opened that last May. And we have plans to open in LA. We have plans to open in Miami sometime this year, and also Paris. So like all of these in the pipeline. So international growth is like one area, but also like expanding on our services. So we, I guess we were one of the first to do luxury experience piercing and welding and tattooing in our store. So just expanding more on that services, because it really gets people engaged and people come in to build memories. We have bridesmaids and we have generations coming in for that piercing and welding experience. So that's sort of like where the evolution is in terms of the brand.
It's phenomenal. And I love so much that you have become this experience bricks and mortar led retail brand, and equally Varley is. And I actually remember walking down the King's Road last year, and there were you guys, and you had your hoarding up, and Rixo was there, and Jimmy Fairley was there, and we walked, I can't remember who else, and I was with a colleague, and we walked down the road, and I said, this is so cool to see. I was like, I feel like we've watched these businesses from day one. It's still as popular a destination as it was. I mean, my 13-year-old, she would happily put a camp bed on the road full time. But, you know, it's so cool to see it thriving with a whole new generation of brands giving something totally different and yeah, really thriving. Who would have thought it?
Yeah, it's an amazing street, like steeped in history. Yeah. So it's such a privilege to actually have a brick and mortar store there.
It used to be back in the day. No mobile phones, meet you at McDonald's.
My sneaky cigarette
downstairs at McDonald's.
Was on King's Road. There was a cafe called Blush and something, and I was a waitress there aged, I think, 18.
Just Posh Boots?
Yeah, do you remember?
Exactly.
Yeah. The little outside,
by Russell and Bromley and Boots?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
What was it called?
I was Everyone's a terrible
waitress.
Everyone's
going to be shouting at the screen or the phones going, this is what it was called. How did you know your ideas were worth pursuing? I ask you that question. So for people listening who have an idea, what advice would you give before you take the plunge?
For me, it was a gut feeling. It was a combination of gut feeling and what existed in other markets. So I knew this would work because from a consumer point of view, I wanted this, something like this that didn't exist. And this whole demi-fine jewelry category, it existed back home in Asia for like decades. I always shopped that, but that just didn't exist in Europe.
I think for us, it was a similar, it was kind of, like I said, we didn't look for that gap in the market, but I quickly realized there was one because no one else was creating leisure wear that felt elevated and elegant, but was still like functional. And then it started as an idea. And then I think as we evolved and the world evolved, the brands also evolved with it to the point now where I don't really know who our competition is. We kind of created our own category. Space in the market and own category. Saks actually coined contemporary leisure wear as a category for especially for Varley on their floors, because you know, we didn't sit in active wear, and we like sat in between active and their contemporary fashion brands. So
it's like everyday leisure wear all day leisure wear, isn't it?
Even if you're not working out, it looks so smart and great.
Oh, on a Saturday, pair of Varney leggings, a good shirt, and a fleece, or something like that. That's all I want to wear on a Saturday. I mean, like, and repeat.
No, it's great.
How did you, I mean, testing, you tested a lot, right?
Tested a lot. And I think also just our branding, our product evolved over the course of time. Like what we started with day one is probably not what we ended up with. So it just evolved as we more we learned within the category. But when we, I guess, brought it to market, a lot of people had a few negative views on an RTD, and they were like, oh, that's really sugary, it's really sweet, kind of, it's very lowbrow, it's like, no thanks, I don't want to be serving that. But now, you know, we've now changed the narrative, and we're stocking in, you know, 5-star properties who are coming to us, and we're making bespoke blends that, you know, and they're charging £25 a serve for our pre-batch cocktails, because it's like, well, it's like a mixologist has made it there and then. And I think that is a shift in how people are viewing an RTD category.
Yeah,
it's still a very new category, and I think it's nearly overtaken how the likes of gin, the RTD category itself, is really, you know, becoming a breakthrough offering now, which is brilliant.
People say you don't have to reinvent the wheel, just do it better. Has that been something that you've consciously all done? I mean, none of it was new, was it? It was also about creating a brand and a lifestyle around, I think, for all of you. You're all a brand. You know, we work at Lux & Co. with quite a lot of clients, and we say, you know, part of our mission is to make your customers proud to wear the diamond store, proud to make you know, there's a coolness to all of your brands that you want, that you're proud of to be a customer of.
And I think brand awareness is paramount to your success. I think where we did get a bit of luck is that our brand came about during COVID, and everyone was at home.
Good name.
Everyone was at home, and they had nothing to film, no content. So we collected quite a few amazing ambassadors who came to us and said, you know, we'd love to try your product, because traditionally, normally how marketing would work in the normal world, you know, you'd have to wait in line because everyone's so busy, but because, you know, obviously the world was in lockdown, no one had, you know, much content to work with. And also a lot of really big brands were coming, and they were doing a lot of gifting. So we were able to do a lot of marketing on a shoestring budget that you'd normally have to pay a lot for.
And I guess for F&B, that's the beauty of it, isn't it?
Yeah. As opposed, people love, you know,
a lot cheaper to do than it is for demi-fine jewellery or a Varley fleece. But, you know, gifting is pretty effective, isn't it? In terms of getting your product out there. Maybe we can come back to that. In terms of, well, I'm a real believer in minimum viable product. And I certainly think to sort of new entrepreneurs, young entrepreneurs, get it out there, test, evolve, keep going. And
completely agree.
You know, we're constantly doing that. Is that an approach that you agree with?
Yeah. Absolutely. So when I first started the business, I found this supplier in Korea who completely believed in my vision. I still have, like, to date, no idea why she agreed to do this, but she agreed to, like, you know, produce 5 units of each design. So I could just have a very small batch of products on the website. And I hired a web kind of developer who was a friend of a friend who developed the website for £500. So I started it with like a very minimum, I guess, viable product.
Yeah. And how did you find that manufacturer in
Korea? So in Korea, there's a building where a lot of jewelry suppliers sit. So I was very lucky. I knew that because my mom used to go there just to source things when I was little, and I used to go with her. And like, there were so many people sitting, and no one would talk to me because I didn't speak the jargon. They knew, like, you know, I looked very young. I was 31 at that time, but I probably looked 23. So no one would talk to me except for this one person who was around my age, which was very unusual because the jewelry industry, especially suppliers, they're full of middle-aged men. But she was female, she was 20-something, and I think she was just like very intrigued by the fact that a Korean girl was trying to launch a brand in the UK. So she was like, in a way, very proud of me and wanted to be part of this movement. So she wanted to work with me. So I was quite lucky. So I found her.
So you had your 5 units of each SKU. You had your website for $500. What else did you need to get going and how did you get going?
So I hired a PR agency. So that was my biggest investment because I had to pay like £2,000 a month. So that was a huge investment for me at that time. But I knew PR and marketing was everything It did pay off. So they were trying to manage my expectations, saying like it will take 6 months to get it off the ground. But like we were so lucky. As soon as like I hired the PR agency, within 2-3 weeks, we were featured in the Grazia shopping list and the stylist. I think also because, again, because of the differentiated product. Mm-hmm. DemiFine didn't exist at that time. If we were to launch now, I think it would have taken longer to get traction. But at that time, like that kind of aesthetics didn't exist. So they just picked it up quickly. You know, the moment it was featured in the shopping list on Stylist, like it was sold out. Like obviously we only had a few units, but it was completely sold out. I had to reorder very quickly and put it on pre-order.
Amazing.
Yeah. That's brilliant though. Yeah. Wow.
And what about you, Laura? How did you get it off the ground? Did you raise money first? Did you save money?
We were self-funded. So we actually, in some ways, I think it was the best thing we ever did. Coming up to 10 years. We sold our house that we lived in to like fund the business, but it wasn't like we had this massive pot of money that all of a sudden we were pumping into the business. So we had to be really careful about how we went about it. And at the time, D2C business, direct to consumer business was so fashionable. You know, it was the days of the Glossiers and the Aways, and everyone was like D2C, digital marketing, spend. Yeah. And we didn't have that luxury. Like that was never going to be what the route that we could go down. So we knew we had to create a quality product, but also it had to be aesthetically pleasing and attract via its, we always said we'll attract via its aesthetic and retain via quality, and that was our principles.
Love that.
And we created our first sample collection and we went via wholesale, which at the time was deemed to be very unfashionable. Like people the old school approach. And we built our wholesale business up to now the point where we've got every wholesale account we could possibly want. We're in about, like I said earlier, 1,000 stores worldwide. And they've been our best billboards.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Who's your biggest wholesaler?
They vary, obviously, season to season. But, you know, we've got Net-a-Porter in America. Nordstrom's pretty big for us. But we've got amazing partners that we've worked with for years. And, again, we wouldn't be where we were today if it wasn't for our wholesale partners.
Where's the most off-the-beaten route you can buy a piece of Varley?
Oh, we're in a lot of towns through middle America.
I've seen it in lots of places. Yeah, it's everywhere really, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so wholesale was really key for you. And in terms of manufacturing the product, like a lot of people say, you know, I've interviewed many entrepreneurs over the year, asking them how they found their factories, their manufacturers, is like, you know, giving away your granny's bread sauce recipe or something. It's like, you're not having it. You know, what advice do you have for people when it comes to finding manufacturers? Because it's really, really hard. There's a lot of trade shows, aren't there?
A lot of trade shows, being curious, employing good people who have good contacts.
And how scale is obviously hugely important, but just getting going initially is the most important first step. Did you raise money? I mean, you self-funded. How did you both approach it? What advice do you have for others? I know you've raised money since.
Yeah.
Can you give some advice that's sort of, I guess, relevant for people in earlier stage businesses when it comes to raising money?
I think it's really, now, back in the day, angel investment was much easier. I think now, unfortunately, they've made it a little bit more challenging. Just in general, people don't really have the appetite anymore. However, saying that, our investment is broadly angel and then self-funding. And that was it by choice. I think we wanted to also not give away a huge amount of equity so early on.
And that's a key point as well, I think, is to
we
be gotta, really careful in those early days.
And that's what I would say.
Young entrepreneurs don't realise how precious it is. I'm grateful I have my husband breathing down my neck about that. But
I got an email, I don't know if I should say this, but I got an email quite early on.
Do sit.
And I was... we were invited to pitch onto Dragon's Den. And I was just like, you know, it would be a great PR exercise. But, you know, I didn't want to give away 50% of our business for,
That's why the quality people go on and date
it's them brilliant out. Marketing. It's just great. And I actually, I know some brands who we've worked with who have been, they've, it's been super successful in terms of, you know, marketing and PR.
So if you don't want to go on Dragon's Den and give away half your business, how do you find, you said angel money isn't as easy to come by now. You know, it's a tough climate now to raise in. Crowdfunding has sort of...
Yeah, I wouldn't do that either anymore.
I mean, it's sort of had its day, hasn't it? I mean, it's quite cheap money to raise, but anyway.
I think if you get to a certain point in terms of traction, so I self-funded for the first 3 years. I had a flat in Hong Kong, luckily, so I sold that and started the business and funded my life. I didn't pay myself for the first 5 years. And then once I got to 1 million revenue, because I knew that was the sweet spot, because it's so hard to sell a brand just on a deck, I think.
Yeah. And then you have a proven concept.
Yes, exactly. That's what you need. And once you have like 1 million, I think like investors take you more seriously. Yeah. They think, okay, like she means business. So like I was waiting for this like 1 million mark before I went to angel investors.
And then finished. At 1 million you went to angel.
Yes, I did. So
and how did you access those angel investors?
So I met since I told people that I was raising money, they would introduce me to people. Mm-hmm. But the majority, a big chunk came through a pitch event, because you need a lot of, I guess, traction and momentum. Mm-hmm. Whereas like if you meet individuals, they're willing to put in like, maybe like 50K or 100K max per person. And then you need to aggregate all of them. And you have to create this sense of momentum. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to do that individually. Whereas if you do that in a group and everyone wants you, they can see that. And they just like all want you.
Laura, what's your experience advice when it comes to raising money? And when did you
It's like dating. It has to be. Ben and I both hated raising, but we were similar to you where we waited for as long as we possibly could, almost too long, because our business was experiencing like 100% year-on-year growth, and with that came inventory demands and cash flow demands. And we cut it fine until we raised. And I think we totally underestimated...
What year were you in when you raised?
The year I had my daughter, so 2019, we raised.
And you launched in
2015, yeah. Okay. And we had quite a proven concept by then. We were well over the 1 million mark. And actually, we thought we were going to raise money because we were living in LA at the time. So we thought we would raise like VC money over there. And we had lots of meetings. And I have to say, they were terrifying. Our like growth expectations weren't aligned at all. People were just talking about top line growth at all costs, inflation of figures, and it was something that Ben and I felt really uncomfortable about because we wanted to build a profitable, sustainable business. This was our baby. It wasn't just something that we wanted to, you know, sell out of in 3 years' time. And it took us a while to find the right partners. And I would say having aligned growth expectations was very, very important.
Unrealistic.
Yeah, and realistic as well. And actually we got two amazing investors, and they've been absolutely fantastic, and we were super, super lucky.
And what is that, private individuals?
Both private individuals. Just I think having two has been nice as well, and not having a million of investors to report into.
I think keeping that cap table tight is really key.
Yep.
I think a lot of people, I've spoken to a lot of people where they've got, you know, 20 plus. I just don't even know how you would even do that.
Yeah. I think managing.
I think managing and also just picking and choosing. You know, I think we've now stopped. We're not taking on any more angel investment, and that's by choice. And I think you have to know exactly when to draw a line, and then when to go to your next strategy in terms of what that next, you know, funding plan will look like.
My advice as well would be, it takes longer than you ever think it's going to take, because I wish somebody had told me that, because I thought it was like, you have a few meetings, you meet the right investor, you sign the deal, you get the money.
Is and this for angel or VC?
Everything in general.
Yeah. Just raising
all of
money.
These, raising
it's
money,
such
all
a
of these,
distraction, yeah. such a yeah. full-time
And it
job.
Takes so much time.
It is very distracting from the day job, and you're trying to grow the business and market and PR and logistics and fulfillment and then fundraising on top of that is a whole other ball game. So I think we probably all agree, delay it for as long as you can, even if it means cutting it fine. Yep. You know, cash flow is
the killer,
key king, whatever you want to call it. But you know, it's very hard to get that equity back and you know, stay in control for as long as you can. Are there other challenges that you went through in the early days? Anything you would do
differently? Connie, I'm coming to you first.
Yeah, yeah. I guess like anything I do differently, I'd hire a creative talent early on because I relied a lot on freelancers, but it's incredibly valuable to have someone who understands the DNA 100% and who's completely committed to a brand, your brand, if you're building a brand. So I would hire those key, I guess, photographers, graphic designers, and jewelry designers earlier on, like right at the start.
I so agree. We have Lux & Co now, as you know, and I was just saying to a client the other day, I said, don't be afraid when the time comes to change the brand, to evolve the brand. You know, you've all got very strong branding. I was talking to someone the other day and I said, you know, you've done really well with the branding that you've got, with the name you've got, with the web that you've got. I was like, but if you want to go to the next level, if you want to be taken seriously in your category, in the industry, whether it's press, buyers, influencers, you know, you really need to look the part. And there isn't a lot of tolerance, I think, for weak branding at a certain level, is there? You can get away with it, as I said, minimum viable at the beginning, do the best that you can. But it's so key to your
it's
success.
It's the first thing they see, right? Yeah. The aesthetics. Yeah, yeah. And as shallow as that sounds, you know, liquid on lips, I always say, is for us speaks volumes. However, you still need them to get the liquid into their home and or across the bar and try it, and then the liquid on lips does get it over the line. But
hopefully that was pretty good, isn't it? But I used to work for Coty in fragrance marketing, and analysing the consumers, what was important, the juice, the smell of the juice, was bottom of the list. It was everything else that came first. So yeah. Branding, creatives, that's great advice. Tash, early day advice, lessons?
I think for us getting, you know, again, we were trying to get ingredients was challenging, you know, just to try and get good organic ingredients. And I think we wanted to build a product that was, you know, not just putting chemicals into, you know, us. And when I say that, you know, you can put droplets in to make it taste like mint, but it's not real mint. For us, we didn't want to compromise on, you know, how the drink was made. So that was challenging. I think also margin control. I think for us, one thing with that, we could have probably compromised by putting in things like the little droplets I spoke about. But for us, again, when you do a taste test with our drinks versus competitors and you pour them into a glass and see the color change, it's quite something. And I think sometimes you have to pick a lane and maybe you'll make little less margin, but your quality will be there. So I think the challenge of kind of overcompensating that, because sometimes people just want a cheaper option and they don't really care if it tastes better or not. So, you know, we turned down, we had a few big listings, big opportunities that we just said were not the right product for you because they were trying to, you know, push us down, get our margin squeezed to every last inch of his life, and the product would have been compromised, and even it would have probably served us a really valuable contract. It just wasn't worth compromising.
I do think we're in an era where quality is so important, and I can think of some brands over the last 17 years that have sold and sold and sold and sold, and they were very unethical and very poor quality and very cheap. Do you think we're in an era where people will pay a bit more? Look, I'm well aware of the economic climate, so I don't say that without considering that, but I think we're buying less and buying a bit better.
Exactly. That's the thing. Less, but better quality.
Yeah. For Varley, you said aesthetics, but win them with the aesthetic and
retain for quality.
The quality, yeah.
And we also say that we're in the pursuit of quality in all that we do, and to look after one another, and everything else should take care of itself. That's like our company motto. So quality's always been at the forefront. And I agree, especially in this day and age. And I think across all brand touch points, whether that's your website, the product, the store experience, customer service experience, I think the consumer now really cares.
Yeah. I think there's just really low tolerance for mediocre, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Whether it's customer service, whether it's packaging, whether it's quality of the product, the web experience. Unfortunately, there is a really high standard. I would say do less and do it better. Minimum viable, but the standard has got to be has got to be good. Are there other lessons from your early days, advice you would share?
Yeah, I agree with hiring good talent. And actually, but we did quite well with freelancers early on because we were self-funded and we didn't have a huge pot of money. Hiring was like risky for us. And also we didn't want to take people away from jobs that they were currently in when we were potentially unsure about our future. So we worked with a lot of freelancers because there was nothing to lose. And also we always found that people who'd worked freelance were quite independent thinkers. So in a startup environment, that was quite useful because they were quite used to like that hectic chaos of sort of working for yourself. And a lot of our freelancers eventually came into Valley full time, particularly on the creative side. So our lead designer was freelancer. Our brand director was freelancer for us.
Wow!
So we did really well on the early, in the early days with freelancers.
Yeah, I think it's we're so fortunate when I started Shadox that freelance world and design didn't really exist like it does now. But definitely as time has gone on, yeah, that is the beauty. But I do believe that in-house for us as a business is definitely gets us the best results. And it's amazing when you start a business to have that.
Yeah.
But and we do have a few freelancers. I'm looking at one of our non-freelance team who works with a freelancer, but it's a freelance relationship that's been going on for a very long time. So it's almost like they're an internal external. But I think having people really on your journey
and that's actually
sharing your vision is really important.
A really good point, because you can hire in someone who has 30 or 40 years experience within the industry, but if they don't understand the growing pains of a challenger brand, it doesn't resonate and it won't work.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that we learned is that, you know, you can bring in the talent all day long and perfectly great at their job, but it takes a certain mindset to understand a challenger brand and the growing pains that what comes with that. You know, as you quite rightly said, cash flow problems, working capital, just the ups and downs, winning and losing, and being able to have a steady hand through that. It isn't for everyone. And I think sometimes people who are a bit more seasoned in their journey, in their, you know, in their, I guess, working experience life, it isn't for them. And I
so agree. We actually interviewed somebody recently and they were great, but their experience was of being part of such a huge machine that I don't think they'd have been able to adapt to our way of doing. They didn't really have the hustle. I mean, they were freaking good.
Yeah. But you want the hustle.
But we needed a bit of hustle and a bit of, okay, well, that works like that, so we'll do it like that, or that doesn't, as opposed to sometimes. And I actually think you learn, we're actually at the time when we're starting to bring in some grown-ups from other businesses, which is so useful to learn from, because we've sort of made a lot of it up.
It's a fine balance, isn't it?
But equally, that on the flip side, you can't have people that are too rigid, particularly early on.
I think there's certain people for certain roles. growth stages of of your business. I think there's actually those people who really thrive early on and they have a hustle and
jack of all masters. Yeah, and you need.
Exactly. And then I think the bigger you get, the more those specialists are needed.
Yeah. Finance, that's one thing I wouldn't compromise. I think bringing all that experience, someone who's really good at building a model, I think is paramount.
I think the more technical roles like finance and operations.
I think you can't mess around with
those.
You
need people with that experience. Yeah.
You need somebody with financial acumen on day one.
And
whether you've got that or not, if you haven't got it, go and find someone else who can do it. But
definitely.
But all of us, we've become successful. Our brands have become successful because we do things so differently, right? And you don't want someone who's too seasoned and tell us what to do, what like the industry norm is.
Well, that's we've had so many people who said, no, this is how you do it in publishing. It's like, well, we've written our own rule book.
I love that.
And it's working. And that's about,
working.
You know, disrupting and doing it totally differently. And I actually think we've got someone who's just had her 10-year birthday at Sherlock's, and we've had someone who's been in the business for 16. And actually, there's nobody that knows it and can do it better. Mm. Bringing in others alongside them is really additive. And you're so right, different stages. But I do think cultivating talent and helping the people that you bring in, even if they are a bit jack of all master of none, helping them develop is really
absolutely
beneficial. Can we talk about acquiring customers? Like, it's a big conversation. We talk about that for an hour at least. But you've got your product, you've got your brand, it looks great, you've got your web, you've got some social. It's sort of meaningless without customers. What advice do you have for getting those first customers over the line, attracting them,
Well, again, it's a different time now. So I think what we did 10 years ago isn't particularly relevant anymore, but wholesale is still relevant. That was our best and cheapest acquisition channel.
Yeah, so I think people don't... Perhaps new entrepreneurs don't see that as
they see it as a potential revenue channel, and then obviously with returns and markdowns, it's potentially not that profitable, and people discount it. But actually, you know, there is an acquisition there as well.
Yeah, so true.
And then also 10 years ago, when we started out, it was the first ever trade show in our industry at the time, which was in Huntington Beach in California. It was called Active Collective, and it was their first trade show, and we appeared at that first ever trade show. And trade shows have always been good for us. We still do about 15 trade shows a year, everything from Coterie, Active Collective, PGA shows. So for us, that's been a great
trade shows.
Yeah, in terms of getting those wholesale accounts. And then we did actually pay our first ever influencer years ago when we started up the business and we were in LA. And that year she was highlighted as being the sort of it girl of Coachella, and it was Rocky Barnes. And at the time she had not that many followers and nothing like she obviously has today. And I think we paid her $300 for a post, and she posted. And from that, I know we acquired a lot of customers as well. So that kind of, that's what got us off to
start. I mean, influencer marketing is not to be underestimated, is it?
Yeah.
Trade shows for you?
Yes, we've done a lot of airline trade shows, a lot in Germany. We've done that, on, which has been great for us. But I think for us, it's such a lengthy process, and I wasn't quite ready for that. I'm quite a why even got back to me? I emailed you last week, and no. So I don't know if it's just a drinks industry thing, but they are very slow, and maybe they also
send me some more. I'll think about it.
Yeah, well, kind of, and you know, and also it's quite a male dominated market. You know,
they're not in such a hurry as we are.
Well, we're just come on, let's go.
Yeah, get shit done. Find a woman. And gifting for you, obviously key in the early days. I mean, lots of partnerships. You know,
lots of partnerships.
That's the beauty of a low, you know, a lower value.
Yeah, and people low cost of goods were so kind to us, and we still have today a band of ambassadors who we still work with, and you know, I guess it's a real give and take relationship. You know, if they're doing something, we'll give them product versus, you know, but we don't traditionally pay our influencers, but we will look after them, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it's not such a transactional relationship, but it's more of a kind of kind relationship that we have for each other. So it's lovely because it's very organic, and it comes that they love the product. So it's not like they're being paid to say, hey, this is the drink you should have. It's coming from the heart. You know?
I always say, ultimately, if no one is asking for your product, if no one wants it, and you're trying to gift them, you've probably got a bit of a problem there with the quality of your product. It's not looking great, is it?
No, I think it's best when it's, like you said, organic and authentic. Mm-hmm. I think the best converting influencers for us are the ones that genuinely love the brand. They've often actually bought it or found it, you know, not directly through us, and then we see that they've tagged us on social.
Yeah,
it's the same for us. It feels...
Yeah, it's brilliant.
And seeking them out that way. Yeah. We've got a client here. Yeah. Right, let's look who's interesting. Yeah. Maybe they're not even an influencer. Maybe they're just influential within their... Mm. I always talk about Tupperware parties.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to be well-known out of your social group.
Yeah, so I actually started gifting to bloggers at that time. So before influencer marketing was huge, we started influencer marketing in a way. So, and if I were to start a brand again, that's what I'd do all over again. Mm-hmm. I'd like just do loads of gifting to influencers, these micro influencers, and also do TikTok. Mm-hmm. I mean, our brand is built around Instagram, but if I were to start all over again, I'd do TikTok at a heartbeat.
Yeah. Any advice that you had from others in the early days? I always love this question. I remember meeting Natalie Massenet many, many years ago, and she was obviously a huge role model to so many entrepreneurs. And I remember her saying, you can be nice and you can be kind and, you know, nurture your network. And I always thought it was good advice.
That's good advice.
Here we are.
Yeah.
What about you?
So when we were thinking about starting Valley, and I was talking about leaving my job, my father-in-law did say to me, You'll probably regret it if you do, but you'll certainly regret it if you don't. And I remember thinking, oh, well, I might as well just have a go. So that was the one thing that rings in my mind. It was the thing that the push that I needed just to be like, just do it. And then one of our investors said to me once, how do you eat an elephant? One mouthful at a time.
Yeah.
So I think about that daily when things feel like overwhelming.
Peel an onion, I always say, lot. One layer of the onion at a time.
So I remind myself that, just one mouthful at a time.
Yeah. With any problem, I think it's all solvable. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But don't
It's not for the faint-hearted. I often say that to my husband, you know, it's...
If it was easy, everyone would do it.
Yeah, and I know it's a cliche to say that, but it's true. Like, it's so true. But for me, I think I got introduced to a gentleman who was VP of Moët Hennessy for 15 years and before that Diageo for 20 years. So a really well-seasoned individual. And I spoke to him. We were probably, 8 weeks old as a business. And he just said to me, you know, what your idea is, you know, to build a premiumized RTD within the space. He said, you know, it's not being done. It's not solution driven. If it's done correctly, you will really, really become a leader within your category. But, you know, you got to stay focused. Don't go off and start doing loads of other different products. Know what your offering is.
You're not wine.
Stay true to that. And I think, you know, 3 years on, I'm still in touch with him. He's a great mentor of ours in terms of advice. And, you know, he's based over in New York and, you know, a phenomenal guy. But yeah, I think it's just having that reassurance from someone who is credible within the industry to say, you got a good idea here.
I think that is really key. I remember Daisy Nashville, the founder of The Deck, saying that she had 100 coffees before she started her business. I would say do your research, test your product, you know, get it out there. Everyone's got friends and networks they can tap into. But just check someone wants your product before you sell your house and invest it in a supply chain.
Georgie's got batch number one, my third bottle I ever made.
Where did the others go?
Well, I think they was all dropped at the same time. Two other fresh. Raging. First bottle.
Anyway, it was a big thumbs up for me. In fact, I posted it on my Instagram.
You did.
She dropped it on my doorstep and knocked down. I posted it on my Instagram. And all these people said, where can I buy this?
Yeah.
I
was like, you were a big supporter, absolutely.
But you know, I really think testing is key, and you did do that extensively. Connie, is there advice you were given that you've
one of my angel investors, Gary, he told me when he was investing, hold on to your equity as long as possible, which is what we kind of discussed. And it was completely counterintuitive to what an investor would say to me. Yes. But that was the best advice ever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about being a woman and what your experience has been as a woman, for better or for worse? Is it the same? Has it got in the way?
My experience has been hugely positive. I feel very supported. I think there's an incredible movement and platform behind women. I felt it particularly 10 years ago in LA and now here in London. And incredibly positive.
Yeah. I think the landscape is changing. I think, you know, back in the day, I know a lot of female founders speak a lot about, you know, having funding issues, you know, not being backed by the likes of PVC, etc. But I do think that landscape is changing now. And I think there's a lot more females coming to the table and on boards, etc. And just, you know, founder-led businesses being backed, etc. I think for me personally, no, I don't think I was ever treated any differently. I think it is different. And I think
we're lucky in this country. We are lucky. Mm. I mean, I think very lucky. Obviously, it's not the same all around the rest of the world. But women are just getting started. Like, I feel, you know, our ability to spin plates and get shit done and, you know, be mothers as well as leaders.
Yeah, I think it's a great era for females. And I think we have such a strong advantage by being empathetic, being able to read the room, all of these things, female characteristics.
I was reading in the FT last night in bed about the CEO of Vodafone and that she was a very effective but slightly different leader. She had a sense of humour, she didn't take herself too seriously, she had empathy, but she could be very direct, and she had earned real respect. Anyway, I screenshotted it and sent it to my husband. Yeah. Look out, we're after you. Some final words of wisdom for people listening and just starting out now. What advice, woman to woman, or to man if they're listening, would you give them?
Oh, do you know what? We always quote, it's actually by Mark Twain, about the best way to get ahead is to get started, which love we love that. Because
you need to write your quotes down, Laura.
They're beautiful. Yeah, good one. So yeah, just get going, get started. There's never going to be a perfect time. I think some people wait around, I'll wait for the kids to start school, or I'll wait till whatever, and actually just get on and do it.
Yeah, agreed.
And I think also you can do it in stages. You don't need to, you know, give up your job and just, it's all or nothing. I think you can get a concept, you can trial it a little bit, you can test the waters, get a part-time job. You know, I know that people don't have the luxury to just go from 0 to 100 and just quit their job and no funding or no, you know, income as such.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think there's, you can do it in different stages. And I think we've all probably, you know, we probably did in stages. There was probably really hard growing pains at the very beginning of the journey as such. We didn't all just tools down and off we here we are. You know, it was a journey as such, you know.
I'd say we've all been at it quite a long time. Let's not add up all the years together.
Yeah. And 20. also be patient along the way, right? Because things take longer than you expect. Mm. As founders and entrepreneurs, we expect things to happen yesterday. But things happen slowly, especially when you're building a brand. So as long as you have a strong vision and you believe in self, it will happen. So be patient.
Yeah, agreed.
I think that's the perfect way to end.
Perfect.
Thank you, ladies. Thank you. Great. I feel very lucky to have sat here with
thanks for having
three
leaders.
That is it for today. If you enjoyed that, then do please rate, review, subscribe, tell your friends, and we will be back soon. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.